Andrew Bacevich is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He is the author, among other books, of America's War for the Greater Middle East and has won the American Book Award. We talked about America's military involvement overseas. I am here with Professor Andrew Bacevich. Sir, thanks so much for joining me today.
Glad to be with you.
So you talk a lot about American foreign policy and particularly military adventurism overseas. Just to start off the frame of this discussion, what events in the 20th century led all of us to believe that war was a good thing, that it was an effective force, and that since we're good at it, we could use it to achieve positive results?
I think the key moment was the end of the Cold War. When the Berlin Wall fell 30 years ago this month, and people said, well, what caused the Soviet Union to give up this contest? I think some observers reached the conclusion that the explanation was that the Soviets had concluded that they could no longer compete militarily. That is to say, we persuaded ourselves that we had achieved something akin to military supremacy. Then hard on the heels of the fall of the Berlin Wall came Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, leading to what we came to call Operation Desert Storm. There was a great deal of trepidation in our country in the weeks running up to the actual campaign. Turned out, of course, that we defeated the Iraqi army rather handily and with very few casualties. And that then led to the further conclusion: not only were we militarily supreme, but the military power was something that could be put to use, not held in reserve, not simply employed to deter, but that we could put military power to work to advance our vital interests. And that was, to put it mildly, an illusion, and one that gave rise to great mischief in the years that followed.
But wasn't that already going on? I mean, would Vietnam be an example of that or no?
Well, no, of course not. Vietnam was an example. First of all, Vietnam was a departure from the overall strategy of the Cold War, which was a strategy of containment. The idea that we were going to hold military power in reserve. Successive administrations persuaded themselves, tragically, disastrously, persuaded themselves that if South Vietnam fell to the North, that this would constitute a great communist victory that would jeopardize the free world. And so we entered that war incrementally, but massively over time, in order to try to prevent that supposed disaster from happening. But nobody believed at that time that military power was something that could be easily put to work in order to advance our political objectives. Mm-hmm. Indeed, the experience of Vietnam seemed to show just the opposite. If you choose to go to war when it's not absolutely necessary, you are really engaging in folly. That seemed to be the lesson of Vietnam. So the conclusion of the Cold War, followed by the Gulf War of 1990-1991, reverses that perception.
Couldn't another lesson of Vietnam for American planners also be that if you're going to go to war, do it against a country you can easily defeat, like Iraq?
Well, it's easy for us to say that in retrospect. At the time, it did not appear that Iraq was going to be easily defeatable. The perception was that as a result of the Iran-Iraq war of 1980 to 1988, Saddam was in the possession of seasoned and combat-hardened forces. That's what many observers believed prior to Operation Desert Storm. I think what we would say in retrospect is that the Iraqi army was poorly motivated, certainly poorly led, and really wasn't particularly interested in fighting the Americans. But that's a reality that came clear only after the fact. Indeed, when we prevailed over the Iraqi army in 1991, there were many voices saying, hey, look, we've just defeated the fourth largest army in the world. Isn't that terrific? But that implied a level of competence to Iraqi forces that they did not possess.
I see. I believe in your book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, you trace the beginning, particularly of the U.S.'s war for the Middle East, to the Carter administration. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, prior to Carter, I mean, so Carter is president in the latter part of the 1970s. He's the middle of the Cold War, actually getting to be to the end of the Cold War, although nobody knows that at the time. During the Cold War, the United States has two major military contingencies that it plans for. The first, the bigger of the two, is to plan for the defense of Western Europe in the face of a potential Warsaw Pact invasion of Western Europe. And the second contingency is the one centered on the Korean Peninsula, but more broadly speaking, an effort to contain the People's Republic of China. What happens under Carter, and this is in response to the Iranian Revolution primarily, well, in response to the Iranian Revolution combined with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December of 1979, those two together result in President Carter deciding that there now must be a third military contingency. And the third military contingency is focused on the greater Middle East. And so we begin ginning up for a war in that region of the world. And that was something that the Pentagon had never even thought at all seriously about in earlier. So what happens is the creation of United States Central Command, the prepositioning of equipment to respond to emergencies in the Middle East, the beginning of exercise programs, the deploying of forces so that they're acclimated to that theater, and then the willingness to begin using forces to act upon the perception that U.S. national security interests are at risk there.
Had before that, though, the Middle East had to be on their radars, right? I mean, there had been some involvement in the past. Are you saying that this
U.S. military involvement was minimal? I mean, the exception, if you want to call it that, was the 1958 intervention in Lebanon directed by President Dwight D. Eisenhower. It lasted a matter of weeks, if I'm not mistaken. I may be slightly, but if I'm not mistaken, it ended with zero U.S. casualties. So we were not geared up to fight in that part of the world until after Carter promulgated the so-called Carter Doctrine.
Okay. I guess more what I was thinking of, but I suppose this wouldn't be military involvement, is things like the 1953 coup in Iran.
Yes. The argument is not that the United States had no interest in the region.
Gotcha.
The argument is that the United States was not militarily involved in the region except in the most minimal sense. Whereas after the promulgation of the Carter Doctrine, thinking about war in the greater Middle East becomes a major preoccupation and indeed becomes a major requirement that ultimately brings us to where we are today.
Okay. And I assume that once you put that, in your playbook, it makes it more likely that you're going to wage war in the Middle East as well.
Yeah. I wouldn't press that too far.
Okay.
But I think there's something to it.
How much of this has to do with the Soviets' involvement in, say, Afghanistan?
A lot. U.S. authorities quite mistakenly interpreted the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan as indicating that the Soviets were now about to, try to expand their influence in Southwest Asia. You know, they were going to conquer Afghanistan, and then maybe they were going to conquer Iran, and then maybe they were going to go after Saudi Arabia. I'm overstating it, but there was that type of thinking that helped to prompt American officials to think that that part of the world was now a military concern of the United States. Add to that, of course, the Iranian Revolution, the loss of the Shah as a perceived American ally in the region, and then, of course, the fact that the revolution itself put in power in Tehran a rapidly anti-U.S. regime.
And do you believe it made sense back then for America to get involved in Afghanistan in terms of supplying people with guns and so on?
Well, you have to see the decision to do so. That is to say, the decision to start supporting the Mujahideen against the Soviet occupation. You have to see that decision in the context of the time. We supported the Mujahideen because we thought that that would help us win a trick in the Cold War. And in a sense, it did. Afghanistan war turned out to be an absolute disaster for the Soviet Union, and certainly contributed to the end of the Cold War and to the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Empire. So you view it from that angle, and it was a brilliant stroke. You know, we didn't lose any U.S. forces. It was the Afghans who were doing the fighting and dying, and the Soviets who were doing the fighting and dying. So from a Cold War perspective, genius. From a perspective of what I call the war for the greater Middle East, it wasn't genius. In effect, what we were doing was radically destabilizing Afghanistan, turning it into a chaotic place that essentially was not governed, creating it into a place that was going to become a place where anti-U.S. Terrorists would be able to gather and to plot against us.
And was that just totally unforeseen, or was there any indication that may have led them to believe that?
I'm sure you could go find some scholarly article that forecasts the possibility of blowback, but that concern did not affect decision makers in the Carter administration or the Reagan administration.
And you had mentioned earlier that part of the popular belief for why we won the Cold War is that we overwhelmed the USSR militarily.
Right.
This Afghanistan topic kind of plays into that. Is that belief true? Is it accurate?
Is what true?
Is the belief that the reason we won the Cold War and the reason the Soviet Union collapsed because we outspent them with our military? And
I would assess that as one factor, but not the decisive factor. The Soviet Empire collapsed and the Soviet Union collapsed because organizing a state and an empire, according to the principles of Marxism-Leninism, did not produce the intended results. It was a country that simply, the empire and the Soviet Union, simply failed to deliver on the promises that it was making to the people. So the principal reason, in my judgment, for the collapse of the Soviet Union is that it was an entity that simply did not work. And so the explanation for collapse is internal, not external.
Okay. Going forward to Iraq, the Iraq war in the 2000s, how much of the enthusiasm to launch a war and the willingness was because of this easy victory in the Gulf War?
Well, I think there's a couple factors here. One, we have to keep in mind the extent to which the attack of 9/11 was a major shock to the system. It exposed us as vulnerable in ways that we simply had never imagined. In that sense, the impact was orders of magnitude greater than, for example, the impact of the attack on Pearl Harbor back in December 1941. But I think along with that, there is the fact that key decision makers within the George W. Bush administration were indeed infatuated with military power. They did believe, based on the end of the Cold War, based on the experience of Operation Desert Storm, that we had a military machine that simply could not be stopped, and therefore that victories would come easily and cheaply. And they further believed that victory over Iraq would position the United States in order to reorganize the large parts of the Middle East to make sure that there would no longer be any terrorist threats emerging from that part of the world. They vastly overstated the capacity of our military. They vastly overstated the capacity of the United States to rearrange nations to suit ourselves, and the thing turned out to be a massive disaster.
When you talk about the belief that they thought that they could rearrange nations in order to reduce or eliminate the threat of terrorism to the U.S., how could they have thought that was a reasonable belief, just given not only American history, but all history?
They thought they were smarter than anybody else in the room. We're talking about people like Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz. They believed they were masters of the universe. They overestimated their own capacity. But they also drew on a somewhat mythic interpretation of American history, particularly centered on the aftermath of 1945. After World War II, the United States did play a significant role in reforming Germany, West Germany at least, and Japan, and in bringing those two nations toward liberal democracy of a sort. Now, why one would think that, oh, if we did it in Japan back in 1945, we can do it in Iraq in 2003, don't ask me to explain that. But they did think that they thought that history showed that the United States has this ability to take defeated adversaries and to, you know, align them with our values. This obviously, in retrospect, was a preposterous expectation.
In their ideal model, what would have been the end result of the war?
A short war, decisive victory over Saddam Hussein, followed by a fairly quick conversion of Iraq into some version of liberal democracy aligned with the United States of America, hosting residual U.S. forces. If that had happened, then the United States would have been in a position to turn to Assad's Syria, turn to Saudi Arabia, turn to Iran, turn to Egypt, and say, hey, fellas, unless you play ball with us, unless you change your system, unless you introduce liberal reforms, unless you give up any notion of challenging American hegemony in the region, then you will ultimately suffer what Saddam Hussein's regime suffered. I don't believe for a second that people like Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz thought that we were going to have to go invade all these countries. They believed that the example of what had befallen to Saddam Hussein would be sufficient to get others in the region to wise up. And you'll notice I was mentioning not simply our enemies in the region, but also our supposed friends. The idea was to bring liberal reform to a region of the world in which liberalism had had next to no presence.
When you mentioned a democracy that would be aligned with American power, are those two objectives at all in conflict for, say, Iraq?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to describe for you what I believe was the unstated strategic intention.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to describe for you a notion that had any plausibility.
Okay.
People were mad. And the evidence of their madness is on display in that part of the world today, where the reckless use of American military power has created instability and has empowered illiberal forces such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
That's an interesting point, because do you believe that the war on terror, just more broadly, has made us safer?
No.
Okay.
No, but the concept of waging terrorism as a tactic, you know, it's like submarine warfare. It's like strategic bombing. You don't go to war on submarine warfare. You go to war with the nations that use submarines in ways that are, you know, threatening to your own well-being. So the notion of waging a war on terror, and many, many, many people have made this point more eloquently than I can, waging war on terror was from the outset an absurd proposition.
Okay. Talking about the war in Afghanistan now, what was the motivation for the U.S. planners to do that? Because that came very shortly after 9/11.
Yeah, so there was a plausible rationale for intervening in Afghanistan. And the plausible rationale was to make it clear that any nation anywhere that provided sanctuary for anti-American terrorists was going to pay a very heavy price for doing so. So we needed to punish the Afghan regime, make an example of the Afghan regime. That was necessary. Where things go south, of course, is after we overthrow the Taliban, what next? And what the George W. Bush administration decided, and the Obama administration continued, was that we were going to engage in a nation-building effort in Afghanistan, again, to try to convert, really to bring Afghanistan into modernity. So our agenda included democratization. Our agenda included ensuring that the Afghan authorities respected human rights, and especially women's rights. And of course, these are very admirable goals. But just because they're admirable doesn't make them plausible. And, you know, here we are 18 years later. We're still stuck in Afghanistan. They still don't have a government that is legitimate. They still don't have security forces that are able to maintain the control over Afghan territory. And although we have tried any number of approaches to make an end to this war, none of those efforts have failed. And so we end up with the longest war in our history on our hands, clearly unwinnable. And at this point, you sort of scratch your head and say, why are we even there? And that's a question that's difficult to answer.
I want to touch on that, but real quick, when you mentioned the idea that you know, we'd be bringing some of modernity to Afghanistan,
right,
and things like women's rights, there might be people who would question the plausibility of whether those were their the real heartfelt intentions of American planners at the time. You know, like a group of Republican operatives, maybe they, you know, if they really cared about women's rights, they might do something at home Do you follow me? I mean, is there any way you can look at
what's the alternative explanation? Let me be clear. It's not that was the sole objective.
Right.
The expectation was to convert Afghanistan into a modern nation state would make it far less likely that Afghanistan would become a place harboring anti-American terrorists. So the nation building was meant to create a state that was able to control its own territory and to govern effectively. And whether cynically or sincerely, the idea of promoting human rights was part of the argument made for what we were trying to do.
When you said make an example of Afghanistan, to what extent was the choice of Afghanistan then arbitrary?
It wasn't arbitrary. That's where Al-Qaeda was based. That's where the plot that culminated in 9/11 was germinated. Now, my personal view would be that it's rather arbitrary to say that, you know, terrorism rooted in Afghanistan is the particular problem that we have to defend against. But in the wake of 9/11, that's the way it appeared. In the wake of 9/11, people said, where did this come from? And the answer was, oh, it came from Afghanistan. Contrary facts that complicated that conclusion, that is to say, 15 of the 19 hijackers come from Saudi Arabia,
right,
didn't really enter into the equation.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because it would seem like the immediate choice of the vast majority of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia would be to at least ask them some serious questions, right?
Well, there you go. Yeah, that's ought to have happened.
Okay.
I mean, it really ought to have led senior U.S. national security officials to revisit the U.S.-Saudi special relationship. But going beyond that, it ought to have caused U.S. officials to question the notion that somehow we have vital interests in that part of the world, to question the notion that we need Persian Gulf oil, because we don't.
Is that the real reason why we're so tight with Saudi Arabia? Because people are, especially now, after killing of Jamal Khashoggi and so on, people are very skeptical of this alliance.
They should be skeptical. I mean, it's unnecessary and embarrassing, I think, that we have this close relationship with this country. Where did this relationship come from? Well, it came from oil, of course, major factor. I think since then, it's the willingness of the Saudi government to buy billions and billions and billions of dollars of American weaponry figures as one factor in explaining the persistence of this relationship.
Does the buying of American weaponry, does that ultimately benefit the people of this country, or is that something that benefits like Boeing and Raytheon and so on?
Well, it benefits the arms makers. Of course, all those companies are publicly traded, so their profits benefit stockholders. Those companies employ large numbers of Americans, and I think for the most part, they're probably pretty good jobs in terms of pay and benefits. Those companies are intimately involved in American politics. They underwrite think tanks in Washington, D.C. They contribute to the political campaigns of members of Congress. So it's a lot of money going in and out of a lot of pockets. And I think that also then makes makes many disinclined to examine the U.S.-Saudi relationship too critically.
Yeah, that's the making contributions to the campaigns of members of Congress. That is amazing to me that that's legal and allowed. And that's not something that tanks people's campaigns if you brought it up.
It's none of this necessarily has to happen directly, right? It's indirect.
How so?
Don't ask me to explain the ins and outs of political finance. I am not.
Okay. But somehow the money arrives. Okay. You've said before that the Afghan war, it's been forgotten while it's still underway. Which is certainly true. I mean, there's no parades for Afghan veterans or anything like that. Is this a war that's just designed to go on forever, or is there an end game in any?
Well, there are efforts underway by the Trump administration to negotiate an end to the war. The negotiations involve us talking to the Taliban, excluding the Afghan government. It appeared, whatever it was, 8 or 10 weeks ago, that we were on the verge of an agreement. And then Trump himself basically put the kibosh on that. I think the terms of an agreement, which could still be signed, are pretty clear. We're going to leave. The Taliban will probably agree to some sort of a ceasefire. And then once we're out of there, the war between the Taliban and the Afghan government will resume. And in all likelihood, the Taliban will prevail. In other words, it'll be something of a replay of what occurred in South Vietnam beginning in 1973 after we pulled out as prescribed by the Paris Peace Accords.
Now, no president, I imagine, would want to pull out and then have the Taliban just take over. And I imagine that's a big part of the decision why to stay there. But is there any way to exit so that doesn't happen? Or is this just something we're going to have to accept?
Well, I don't know. You know, you can't expect me to predict the future.
Sure.
What we do know is that the calculation at the end of the Vietnam War was that there would be what was referred to as a decent interval between the time the U.S. forces left and the time that the Republic of Vietnam collapsed. And the decent interval would make it possible then for U.S. authorities to minimize the embarrassment of failure. And my guess is that something of the same logic probably applies here. You know, if you would imagine, here we are at the end of 2019. Let's imagine that a peace agreement is signed before the end of the calendar year. Let's imagine that the peace agreement has U.S. troops out by, let's say, next summer, the summer of 2020. If the Afghan government is able to hold on for 2 years to 2022, and at that point the Taliban takes over in Kabul, how many Americans are going to care? My guess is not many. So that decent interval will provide a certain cushion that will disguise the failure.
When we talk about the separation of the public from the reality of war that's going on, in one of your books, Breach of Trust, you say that public separation sort of began with the split in Vietnam. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I think that toward the end of the Vietnam War, when the conscription system was collapsing, Richard Nixon created the all-volunteer force, which ended up basically being a permission slip for the American people to disengage from their military. We went from relying on citizen soldiers, which had been the tradition in our country, to now relying on a professional military, what the founders of our republic would have called the standing army. And although there is certainly a great deal of rhetoric about our respect and regard for those who serve in this all-volunteer force, the truth is, at least this is my view, that there's not a hell of a lot of attention being given to where those soldiers go and what they're doing. This gives the people in power a free hand to do with the military as they will. What they need to do is to make sure that they keep casualties low. When U.S. casualties are high, then the American people wake up and pay attention. If U.S. casualties are low, then the American people tune out. Doesn't matter how many people who are not Americans are being killed. We don't really care about that. Doesn't even matter whether or not we're achieving our objectives. What matters is if there are few Americans being killed, then Washington gets a free hand to do what it wants to do. And I think that very much describes what's going on in Afghanistan, but also, for example, in Syria and in large parts of Africa, where we have a growing U.S. Military presence on the ground.
Is it appropriate to not have a draft in a democratic society?
Well, I don't know that a draft and democracy have to go hand in hand. What I would say is that a country that places as much emphasis on having and using military power as our country does, then that country ought to be very wary of allowing any gap to develop between the army and society. And unfortunately, it's that condition that we've allowed ourselves to drift into.
Okay. The only reason I said a democratic society, just the idea being that, you know, if this is a war that people generally want, then perhaps it's a war that people generally should serve.
I mean, but Canada is a democracy. They're doing fine. They don't have conscription. But on the other hand, Canada doesn't pretend that using Canadian military power around the world is somehow essential to the interests of Canada. So it is our militarism that makes the reliance on the all-volunteer force politically problematic.
I see. Is it true that seriousness in Washington is equated with a willingness to use force?
Well, I don't know if seriousness is, but there is, in our politics, the conviction that in order to be qualified to run for the presidency, you have to demonstrate a toughness and a willingness to use force. The negative examples of people like George McGovern and Michael Dukakis, who were viewed as falling short in that respect and failing then to win the presidency, those are lessons that have stuck. I'm not even sure the lessons is a true one, but it has stuck. So we see these moments like the vote on whether or not to invade Iraq. The vote was in 2002. The invasion was in 2003, in which senior Democrats who were seen as considering a run for the presidency made sure that they voted for war. And I'm talking here about people like Senator Hillary Clinton and Senator Joe Biden. And after the fact, they would say, oh my gosh, I was misled, or oh my gosh, that was a mistake. But at the time, the political calculus appeared to be, if you want to promote yourself as a potential commander in chief, then you better show that you're willing to go to war.
And getting to the present day, are you at all concerned about the moves on Iran recently, like the ripping up of the nuclear agreement?
So, you know, my view on Iran is that the Iran nuclear agreement that Obama negotiated was probably the bravest, most courageous decision of his presidency. It is certainly in our interest to prevent the further spread of nuclear weapons in the region. I say further spread because Israel, of course, has them. And it's also in our interest, I think, to find a way to end this hostile relationship between ourselves and Iran, which is a precondition for us to play a more positive role in trying to restabilizing that part of the world. Now, President Trump, of course, has abandoned the Iran nuclear agreement, and that may be just about the stupidest decision of his presidency.
And last question here. Do you think that there could be a more positive way that Americans could view their military power?
Yeah. Don't think of it as an instrument to solve problems. Don't think of it as an instrument to overthrow regimes that we don't like, or to try to spread American values. Purpose of the American military should be to defend and to deter. That's what it used to be. That's what it should be again.
All right. On that note, Andrew Bacevich, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, thank you to Andrew Bacevich. Thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.